And I'm very pleased today to welcome Lynn Chu, who's with Women's Empowerment in Muslim Contexts, and then also have here Asfin, who is from Indonesia and is going to talk with us as well about some of the issues that the organization is working on. And she's from Jakarta Legal Aid Institute and is also with the Coalition for Anti-Pornography. So, Lynn, welcome to FIRE. Would you talk about yourself a little bit in terms of the organization and what brings you to this conference?
Well, At this moment, I'm working with this research communication program called Women's Empowerment in Muslim Contexts. We have research sites in Indonesia, Iran, Pakistan, and China, and also a cross-border component which works with women migrant workers from Indonesia who are working in China, in Hong Kong especially, Macau, Taiwan. So the main issues that we are looking at is how women understand their own empowerment, their own situations, how they conceive, how they understand they and analyze the obstacles that there are there in their own sites, in their own communities, towards them reaching their own, acquiring their own empowerment, and you know, empowerment in the sense of being able to take control of their lives and to try and change and transform structures. One of the main obstacles at this moment is the rising political Islamization in Indonesia, and that's why my colleague, a member of our network in Indonesia, is here with me, and she would like to talk to them about a petition that we're running, because in this whole context of a rising Islamization in Indonesia, an anti-pornography wet has just been passed by the parliament in Indonesia, which is very, very discriminatory as well as affecting women very much because of its definition of what pornography is and the lack of controls as to how this bill is going to be implemented. So I would like you to ask Asmina about this.
Asfin, thank you very much and welcome to FIRE. Would you first talk a little bit about yourself and why you got involved in this issue?
I'm Asfinawati. I'm a director of Jakarta Legal Aid Institute, and along with the civil society NGOs in Indonesia, we advocacy on to refuse the anti-pornography bill before it passed by our parliament, because it will control women's body, criminalize women, but the basic idea of this law is come from the some of interpretation of Sharia law, that women body is like a sin, like a sin, sin giver. So because sin come from the woman body, the woman body has to control by government.
And what impact has this had on women?
It will criminalize first the victims of women trafficking women, and it's also criminalize the lesbian, gay, and other different with government thing, different social orientation. And it will criminalize women who wearing or acting or moving in front of public in a different way of government thing. Yes, like you all of sensuality and nakedness are prohibited by this law.
So the focus is more on the women and not so much on the men who are involved in trafficking or involved in procuring
yes,
women for sex,
etc. Yes, even if our government will say that, will arguing about it is for all of people in Indonesia, but in the reality, the most trafficking victims is women. And also the the debate on our parliament talk a lot about the how women artists were dressing or moving publicly as an artist.
When was the law passed?
It's just passed on 30 October 2008. And yes, that's why we are calling the international community to give petition support to Indonesian to revoke, to ask our government and parliament to revoke that law as soon as possible.
And how big a movement, or are you? What are you doing internally as far as opposing this new law?
Yes, we together in Indonesia now collecting our heritage, like a traditional art, traditional culture, traditional dance, who can address by this law, because our heritage is supposed to be admire on women, and women it's used to wear open shirt, open dress, and it will strictly prohibited by law. So we try to collecting our tradition, and then we also make a lot of pressure demonstration to our parliament and government. And the last, we plan to go to the constitutional court to make a judicial review on that law.
Okay. I'm also very pleased to welcome Vivian Wee, who is the director of the organization Women's Empowerment in Muslim Context. And Vivian, welcome to FIRE.
Thank you.
Would you talk about a little more about the organization and how, what kind of work the organization does, and how this particular project with this petition of the Indonesian law, how that represents the kind of work you do?
Yeah. We are a research program consortium, including 8 partners in 4 countries, as well as some cross-border contacts. So our 8 partners are the Southeast Asia Research Center of City University of Hong Kong, where I'm based, and that's the lead partner of the consortium. And we have Shukaga Women's Resource Center, Women Living Under Muslim Laws. We have Solidaritas Perempuan, Semalak Celang Nusa, both in Indonesia. Also in Pakistan, we have the Department of Health Sciences, Community Health Sciences in Aga Khan University. And we also have the International Gender Studies Center in Oxford University, as well as the Center for Environment, Gender and Development, also in Hong Kong, working on a cross-border issues. Okay, so what we are doing in our consortium is to document how women are resisting unfavorable power relations that are imposed on them at micro and meso levels, you know, by the family, by community, by the neighborhoods, by religious groups, and so on. So we've been monitoring this since 1st of July 2006. And in fact, what you just heard about, the anti-pornography bill, is actually the latest escalation of what has been already happening at local levels. Because in May 1998, when President Suharto fell from power, this was followed by a phase of democratization. But because during the authoritarian period, civil society was completely suppressed, so the capacity to organize was terribly weakened. So as a result, when there was democratization, a lot of local spaces opened up, especially with the decentralization processes. And political Islamists have captured quite a lot of the local governments. So the sort of things that are now happening with the anti-pornography bill actually has already been imposed in several districts and provinces even in Indonesia. So there is a kind of and cycling of this situation from the local level up. And so that's why this is now very, this marks a very dangerous transition when what is happening at the local level actually now has percolated up to the national level. So okay. so we are definitely working very closely with our Indonesian colleagues to see how they are organizing and can be supported to overturn this very detrimental bill.
Thank you. Can you, FIRE is very much about stories and storytelling. Mm. Could you talk about a particular case or just, you know, an idea of what it would be like for a woman at the local level who yeah. faces these kinds of issues and what kinds of things may have come up for her?
Yeah. Well, in one of our research sites in Makassar, which is in eastern Indonesia, one case that came to our attention was when there was a young girl who is about 13, and she was at her neighbor's house watching television one night, and because the toilet is outside, so she went outside to the toilet, and when she was going to the toilet, her hand was grabbed by a man who is the son of the neighbor whose house owned the TV set. And then just as the man had grabbed her hand, her uncle, the girl's uncle, came to the door. Then the man pulled the girl away, and so the uncle saw the man pulling the girl away. And then the next day, the rumor was going around the village that, you know, the girl had, you know, done something bad. And she was then summoned to the village head's house, and then she was whipped for, you know, having done something wrong when she herself was actually the victim of sexual harassment. So this is the sort of thing that is happening. And worse still, this village head, now this village head has gained notoriety, and or whether you want to call it notoriety or fame, but among the fundamentalists, he's seen as famous now because he's seen as pioneering this, you know, strict imposition of what he thinks is Sharia law. And he said to our team members who's documenting this case that he admires what is happening in Aceh, because in Aceh they can whip using the arm, the full length of the arm raised up, instead of having the upper arm close to their body, which is actually what is stated in the Quran. So there are these kind of cases where people are imitating each other, even competing, you know, to inflict violence in the name of religion.
Thank you. We also have Farida Shahid, who is with the Women's Empowerment and Muslim Context Organization as well. And she is the Pakistan lead researcher and also the adjunct director of the organization. Welcome to FIRE, Farida. Would you tell us, talk about why, in terms of what Vivian was just talking about, of this whole way of framing girls and women and their behavior so that it's always seems to be blaming the girls and women. And obviously it's within fundamentalism, and it's a political interpretation of Islam. Islam is my understanding of it. But can you explain more of why is this? Why does this happen?
Okay, first I'd like to say hello to FIRE. We're great fans and longtime adherents of the program, so it's very nice to be here again. I guess for us there are two or three things which I think are important. We've been battling in the women's movement for so long against laws and against policies. And one of the things that we have come to realize, and we work with women on the ground, and one of the things we've come to realize is that what's missing, we've worked for very good policies, they may be even pretty good, but they never get to women on the ground. So what we're calling the meso level, the middle level between your policymaking and women's lives, is something that we have to tackle, both as feminists and women's movements from the ground up, as well as trying to ensure that all the hard work that we do with policies actually reaches women. And I think that's one thing that the WEMC research framework allows us to do. So having worked for policies and having worked at the grassroots, can we take on this challenge of the middle level, which is precisely where Vivian was talking about, the space that is being appropriated by people in the political Islamists, but it is also a space that is occupied by the traditionalists. And they speak in the name of culture rather than religion. Sometimes you use religion, sometimes it's tradition, sometimes it's culture. And we are questioning why it is that it's only some people who have the right to decide what our culture is, what our identity is. And I think one of the things that all fundamentalists do is to use an identity of yours and to appropriate it and to make it work against you. So if I fear that by speaking out, I'm going to be thrown out of my community, I will lose all my social assets in terms of what little networking I have, my family, my friends, I'm likely to keep very silent. And I think it's used very deliberately to keep women silent and, of course, others who are oppressed. So that's the kind of dilemmas we're facing. And for us, of course, the so-called Islamization has really been brought in by the military under the 1970s, the military dictatorship, which brought in laws which have nothing to do particularly with Islam but are justified on the basis of Islam. And at the community level where we work, if something is justified in the name of Islam, people find it very difficult to oppose it face on. So we have, you know, the women's movement has done it, and some of the labor movements have done it, but at great risk. So the average woman may not come in because she can't afford to take that risk. But to tell you some of the fun stories that we have on the ground is, despite all of this and the difficult conditions we're working in, for instance, the research has thrown up two young women, Humaira and Taira, they're two sisters, and who started education in a community where nobody had the right to education. So they were the first. Their mother fought for it and insisted. She fought with her husband. She fought with her sons, who were older. And the girls went to school. And when they reached grade 4, they decided, you know, what can we do? They looked at the other girls. First, they said we were very envious because here we were, packed our bags, and we'd go off to school every day, and all our friends would be playing, and we thought, you know, they're having the fun, and we're getting, you know, forced to go to school. Then they realized after a few years that those friends of theirs were not allowed to go out, so they thought, okay, what can we do? And as little girls going to school, what they decided they could do was whatever they learned in school that day, they'd come home and teach their friends in the neighborhood. And so they started, they had no money, so they asked people, you know, when you have notebooks, you don't use all the paper. Then they went and collected all the paper that you didn't use and made it into notebooks. They ran it at home. And they are now 18 and 19. So just to tell you how long they've been at it, they're now running in this very poor neighborhood a school for 500 people. And the 500 people include adults, because they've decided they had to do adult literacy. And they, one, Humaira, who's the principal, the elder sister, she also went through a traumatic experience with the religious leader of the school where she was learning religious instruction, who took a liking to her and then was proposing, and she got very harassed. And despite that, she decided to come out and do this. And, she, you know, so to me, the hope is there. If you can find the people who have that energy and who have that creativity, somehow if we can link up with them and give them the support, then I think things can happen. And they need to be supported to be able to resist more. And I think that's what the women's movement and movements everywhere are all about.
Okay. Thank you, Farida. I'm afraid we're about out of time here. So what I'd like to do is bring it back to Lin Chu, and as one of communications with the organization, what is it you wanted to communicate coming to this conference? What kind of message are you bringing that you would like the 2,200 women here to listen to?
Well, I think our message was that the message that's also included in the way that we are doing the research is that we have to listen, we have to look at the different contexts in which women are living and what their issues and problems are there and what their strategies are. So when we are talking, when we are having our sessions, we are presenting the different contexts, Pakistan, in Iran, in Indonesia, and so that we could compare, we could understand, and we could, you know, see what are the things which work in certain contexts and certain situations, what don't, so that we can learn together and also share that with others and learn the strategies of others who are not living outside of Muslim context, because what we're talking about, rights for women, empowerment for women, is for all women in all contexts. Yeah.
Very good. Thank you. And what I'd like to do is ask, I don't know if you know the website offhand, but we can certainly include it with this interview so that if anyone wants to get more information, that they can contact you if you have that.
Yeah, it's at www.wemc.com.hk.
Okay. Thank you.